Next verse, translation. If a person deviates from the path of the Vedas, in the absence of an emergency, the servants of Yamaraj put him into the hell called Asi Putravana, where they beat him with whips. When he runs hither and thither, fleeing from the extreme pain on all sides, he runs into palm trees with leaves like sharpened swords. Thus injured all over his body and fainting at every step, he cries out, "Oh, what shall I do now? How shall I be saved?" This is how one suffers who deviates from the accepted religious principles. Here's a purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. There is actually only one religious principle, Dharmam Tu Sakshat Bhagavat Pranitam. The only religious principle is to follow the orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unfortunately, especially in this age of Kali, everyone is an atheist. People do not even believe in God, what to speak of following his words. The words Nija Veda Pata can also mean one's own set of religious principles. Formerly, there was only one Veda Pata, or set of religious principles. Now there are many. It doesn't matter which set of religious principles one follows. The only injunction is that he must follow them strictly. An atheist or nastika is one who does not believe in the Vedas. However, even if one takes up a different system of religion, according to this verse, he must follow the religious principles he has accepted. Whether one is a Hindu or Mohammedan or a Christian, he should follow his own religious principles. However, if one concocts his own religious path within his mind, or if one follows no religious principles at all, he is punished in the hell known as Asi Putravana. In other words, a human being must follow some religious principles. If he does not follow any religious principles, he is no better than the animal. As Kali Yuga advances, people are becoming godless and taking up so-called secularism. They do not know the punishment awaiting them in Asi Putravana, as described in this verse. Even if they knew, they wouldn't care also. Okay, any questions about that? Anyone wants to ask anything on this? That's a good point. It's pretty straightforward, yeah.
If one takes up a different system of religion, he must follow the religious principles he has accepted.
Yeah.
But don't we find inherent, perhaps, shortcomings in other religious principles that are outside of the Vedas?
I'm sure they will say the same about us as well. Of course, our answer is, of course, yes. Krishna speaks about it, I guess we could say more objectively. In chapter 16, Bhagavad Gita, he distinguishes between the divine and demoniac natures. And what is the main distinguishing point between the divine and demoniac natures from Bhagavad Gita? Yeah, one follows the Vedas and one doesn't. So Krishna's, he makes it kind of black and white by saying if you follow the Vedas, you're divine, basically, because you're on the... Divine in context of that chapter doesn't mean transcendental. It means the mode of goodness and progressively moving towards the purpose of the human form of life. That's what divine means in context of that chapter. And if you don't follow the Vedic injunctions, then you're a demon, asuric, or non-godly, and you'll be degraded. So then Arjuna nuances this topic in chapter 17 by saying, suppose they don't follow the Vedas, but they do have a set of religious principles that they follow with faith. Are they in the mode of passion, goodness, or ignorance? To which Krishna, he responds that, yes, there are three types of faith, trivida, bhavati, shraddha, according to the modes of nature, sattviki, rajasi, tamasi, cheti, tamasri. You know, you should hear about this. And then he says that faith, which is under the, in the different modes of nature, is according to the dehi nam sa swabhavaja. It is according to the swabhava of the conditioned soul. So, of course, in our understanding of existence, the conditioned soul, cognitive body, the subtle body, carries the impressions from all of his existences. So when he takes birth, he has an inherent prejudice. This is good, this is bad. It's inherent in his the type of subtle body that he has. So according to his mentality, his conditioned psychology, then he evolves a certain type of faith in the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance. And then as a result of his faith, he becomes that which he places his faith in. That's the next verse. Sattva anurupa sarvasya shraddha bhavati bharata. Shraddha mayo yam purusha. Yat shraddha what is that? Yoya Shraddha Sa Eva Saha. Krishna says that the living entity is composed of this faith, or made up of this faith, and he becomes his faith. Krishna says that he becomes his faith. So whatever he's placing his faith in, now the object of his faith is in the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance, because his swabhava is conditioned by the modes of nature. So what Krishna says, whatever he places his faith in other words, is under the modes of nature, then he will become his faith. Means the object of his faith, whatever the deity is, you know, whether it be money or demigod or some materialistic man or something, then he shall become that. He will become his faith in the next life. So you say, do we find something inherently faulty in the other processes of religion? The answer in a clear-cut way is yes, in that they're under the modes of material nature generally. Krishna makes that categorization, that it's not just like we have better rituals than they have, but it's the difference between transcendental religious principles and those which are not transcendental. So if the inherent fault in them would be that they're not transcendental. In the same way that the vast majority of the Vedas are also not transcendental, Krishna says, what is that verse from 245 Bhagavad Gita? Tri-vidya vishaya veda nishtrai gunya bhavarjuna. So Krishna finds fault with the Vedas. He says, you have to transcend those portions of the Vedas that deal with the modes of nature. So also these religious systems are within the modes of nature by observing their activities, their... Bhaktivinoda Thakura and Shikshamrita gives 5 distinguishing factors between religions. I don't recall what they all are. He mentions the mentality of worship. He mentions the rituals of worship, the language which is used for worship, the acharyas that are venerated in a particular tradition. And one other thing, I don't remember, their concept of God, I believe. So these are the 5 distinguishing factors between religious traditions. And by looking at those factors, who has knowledge of the Gita, can distinguish between those within the modes and those outside the modes. So if we say that there's some fault in it, it's that it's because it's contaminated by various modes of nature. And therefore, you can see the types of desires in those traditions are oftentimes materialistic or within the modes of material nature. So that's an inherent fault. Prabhupada's encouraging that people should follow something religious. At the very least, it increases their piety. Just like in chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna mentions that you should just worship him with bhava. Anyone here has bhava yet? Anyone here on the bhava platform yet? So then Krishna says, okay, if you can't do that, you should do sadhana bhakti. And then if you can't do sadhana bhakti, you should follow the Vedas. And if you can't follow the Vedas, then you should do some altruistic activity. So Krishna's being very accommodating in this chapter. Somehow do something that somewhat detaches you from fruit of mentality. And that way, that could accumulate in a general mode of goodness psychology in one birth. And provided you have a sufficient background of Bhakti Sukriti, then you might gain the good fortune of association with a devotee. And your mode of goodness psychology can be assistant to you in some small degree in that. Like in chapter 1 Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada points out, the acharyas point out, that because of Arjuna's compassionate nature, that gave him a qualification for hearing transcendental knowledge. Although it was misplaced, the sense of compassion was there, gave him somewhat of an adhikar to appreciate the same principle on a transcendental level. So Prabhupada's encouragement is that follow something, because Krishna is also kind of encouraging that also in the Bhagavad Gita, although it's not transcendental, follow something that's a little bit mode of goodness at least, and perhaps provided sufficient background of devotional Sukriti, you get a good fortune of association with devotees, you can progress from there. So yeah, we do find some fault in that we're within the modes of nature, as is probably a lot of the practices that we do. Not that bhakti is in the modes, but because we're in the modes, our practices are such. Yeah.
Could you please elaborate on what it means that they, and also speak a little bit about how it's interesting. We say there seems to be such a variety of goals for the variety of conditioned souls, and we can say that our destination is higher than others. But if everyone has a destination, I guess the reason why we say it's higher, I mean, Krishna says the yogi, those who are bhakti yogis, they're the best type of yogi is the yogi in devotion. So is the reason why we think our destination is higher or better than others because on the basis of Shastra, Or is it more like a point of intimacy because you can get closer to God?
Well, to your second question, it's both. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Yanti deva vrata devam pichne yanti pichreer vrataha bhutani yanti bhutegya yanti maya jinopimam. That those who worship the devas, they go to the devas. Those who worship the forefathers, they go to the forefathers. Those who worship the ghosts and spirits, they go to them. In other words, if they worship in the modes of nature, worshiping the devas has to be in the mode of goodness, right? Worshiping the pitchers means the mode of passion. Worshiping and the Buddhas and ghosts and so on means the mode of ignorance. So if you worship in the modes of nature, you'll go to them. So you'll achieve a result which is within the modes of nature. And if you worship me, you'll achieve a transcendental result, eternal. So Krishna is saying, he's not a jealous God, as we hear from the Old Testament. The Old Testament gives an image of God that's very hard to appreciate. They really make us work hard to appreciate God in the Old Testament. But you hear about like a jealous God. Krishna's not a jealous God. He just presents things as it is. If you worship within the modes of nature, you get a result in the modes of nature. If you worship transcendentally, you get a transcendental result. So then, to your second question, Krishna's making a distinguishment between worship of Asat and worship of Sat. And if you worship Asat, then you'll get an Asat result, to which Krishna comments is for less intelligent persons, or persons with meager intelligence. Antava tupalam tesham tabhavati alpamedasam. For those with meager intelligence, they worship various devas in context, things within the modes of nature, something that's temporary, and they get a temporary result. So if you can appreciate that the ephemeral results is the source of our suffering, then you will find that that form of worship which leads to an ephemeral result is the source of our misery. And so if you have sufficient intelligence, you'll give it up. So Krishna kind of just presents, this is what's Asat, this is what's Sat. And then if you're intelligent, of course he gives encouragement, you should do the worship which leads to an eternal result. And so everyone's just achieving the goal of their particular process. Yeah, that's fine, but all the goals are not the same. Some goals are temporary, some are eternal. So those which are eternal are certainly better than those which are ephemeral by dint of our own personal experience. Ephemeral results disappear and then we're frustrated. So in that sense, the answer is, although everyone can say subjectively that we have our own goals, which is fine, objectively they're not the same. Objectively speaking, as far as the presentation of Krishna Gita, one is leads to misery, or is rooted in misery because it's temporary. And therefore, worship of the eternal is better. Now, amongst worship within the eternal, like, for example, different sampradayas worshiping different forms of Godhead, we say in terms of tattva, it's all the same. Well, Rupa Goswami says this in Nectar Devotion. Krishna and Narayana are the same in terms of, but in terms of rasa, Krishna is the highest deity. But subjectively speaking, worshippers of the Asat experience their own deity to be supermost. So you'll find, like in the rasas of Braja, you don't find that the gopas desire to be gopis as such. Although you will find in Shastras they appreciate the bhavas of the gopis. You'll find many personalities throughout the Bhagavatam appreciating the bhava of the gopis. Bhishma, Dev, Uddhava also appreciated the bhava of the gopis. But they never desired to change their own rasa. They had their rasa with Krishna, which they were actually satisfied with. So subjectively speaking, they experienced their own relationship with Krishna to be supermost or super excellent. Although they will appreciate even a higher bhava as exhibited by higher personalities, they will appreciate that you find in the Briha Bhagavatamrita. Every personality is appreciating a more super excellent form of devotion, culminating, of course, in Uddhava at the end of the first, and then Uddhava appreciates the gopis. And so they're all appreciating that someone has a super excellent form of devotion, but they are satisfied in their own rasa with the Lord. So you find Hanuman, he glorifies the Pandavas like anything in the Briha Bhagavatamrita. And so when Narada Muni says, come, join me, let's go meet the Pandavas, Hanuman doesn't want to go, because he's satisfied in his particular relationship. Same with Jiva Goswami, not Jiva Goswami, Anupama. Anupama was the younger brother of Sri Rupa and Sri Sanatan, and they tried to preach to him about the superlative nature of Krishna Bhakti. But Anupama was attached to the Lord as Ramchandra. And so they tried to preach to him. At first, he kind of got on board. But then finally, he wasn't able to do so, for which Sri Rupa and Sri Sanatana were very satisfied with, that he was attached to his own relationship with Krishna. So amongst those who worship the eternal forms of Godhead, they will subjectively experience attachment to the particular form of the Lord that they are worshiping or attached to. And of course, amongst Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we propagate Braja Bhakti. And Lord Chaitanya in particular, of course, came to distribute a particular form of the Madhurya Rasa. So it's not surprising that the vast majority of Gaudiya Vaishnavas would be attracted to that ideal in their practice. And it's not surprising that most of our acharyas are also complete embodiments of that highest ideal, Braj Bhakti. Although, still there are others within our tradition who had other rasas, and they were satisfied with those rasas. For example, Hiridoya Chaitanya, even our Srila Prabhupada, although that's a point of controversy. I don't think so. I think there's plenty of evidence showing that Prabhupada was very much attached to the Sakya Rasa, an intimate form of the Sakya Rasa, which is also called the Sakya Bhava. Anyway, so the point is, subjectively, they experienced their own relationship with Krishna to be super excellent. And therefore, there is no need for changing it or aspiring. Now, as far as the first question comes, what does it mean that you become your faith? And a simple way of thinking about it is that whatever is the object of your worship, like your deity, then you shall become like that. That's how Baladeva Vibhushana and Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur speak of it. So Krishna is the object of our faith. So we become like Krishna, Satchinananda, you know, Vigrahas, and exchanging love with Krishna. If you worship the devatas, you become like them. You know, if you worship the devas, you get a devata-like body to do devata-like activities. So that's the simple meaning of you becoming your faith. You are your faith. The idea, another idea of thinking about it in terms of logic, is that, as I mentioned before, faith is the underlying factor of movement in existence. Without faith, there can be no movement, no forward movement. It is faith that keeps movement determined towards a particular goal. So once you set an ideal that you want to embody for yourself, the idea is that your faith will continue to push you toward that goal until you fully embody it. And so if I have the ideal of Braj Bhakti, then my Shraddha will force me to move towards that ideal until I fully embody it. Now, because the external feature of Shraddha is Sharanagati, as mentioned by Jiva Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur highlights that point also. So then, whatever we have faith in, we take shelter of that, whether it be a person, whether it be an object, whether it be an ideal. That's where we find our shelter. And oftentimes we think we have faith in Krishna, but when there's some disturbance in our life, we come to understand where our shelter is. And oftentimes we may find that our shelter may not be in the holy name, it may not be in Krishna Katha. It's in, like, you know, how you say, getting back at someone. Like someone does something, betrays you, or writes an article about you, and instead of just taking shelter of Krishna in the holy name and just shrugging it off so you can focus on transcendence, you take more shelter in writing another article to counteract that article and get devotees teamed up on that one individual and so on. So we see that our faith is actually not in Krishna, but in some material calculation. So Shraddha is a very subtle thing because the soul is composed of Shraddha. It's a very subtle thing. So we may think that we have faith in Krishna, which may just be a mental concoction. And then we're exposed. We expose ourselves when we take shelter of other things than Krishna, especially when we're in a time of difficulty. So anyway, the idea is that Shraddha will determine how you take shelters. So for those who have full faith in Krishna, they surrender to Krishna. And then that surrender, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes it as the doorway which leads to the kingdom of prema. In other words, bhakti without Sharanagati is like a body without prana. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this in Sharanagati, his songbook. The first song he says that Sharanagati is the bhakatera pran, the life, air of the devotee. So any of you may have experienced being winded before. You ever experienced being winded before? I only had that experience one time when I was playing flag football. I never played flag football after that. You know, someone knocked me down, and all the wind comes out of you, and you feel like you're gasping for air. So similarly, bhakti without Sharanagati is like a body without life air, prana. So you're just, in other words, you're struggling. So the reason we find ourselves tremendously struggling in bhakti is because we're lacking in surrender, which means to say we're lacking in shraddha, actually. So the beginning of our sadhana is often described as the maturation of shraddha. The idea is that in sadhana bhakti is about progressive sharanagati. In the first half of the cultivation of sadhana, is about progressive sharanagati, which is considered to be completely cultivated at the stage of ruchi. I've mentioned this many times, mentioned by Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhakti Tattva Vivek. And then after ruchi arises, that ruchi will be the governing factor for your forward movement, which is also a type of taste. You know, loba moya shraddha means that there's ruchi, and that loba takes over the movement of your Krishna consciousness. Until then, it's called as Buddha Yoga, right? The intelligence is required to cultivate the heart and to keep our shraddha a little bit steady. We're requiring intellectual discrimination and so on until we develop ruchi. But the idea is that I have faith in something, that's my ideal, my object of worship, and I take shelter of that. And so my shraddha will continue to push me toward that ideal until I completely embody it. So in that, you become your faith. Yo yat shraddha sa eva saha, he becomes his faith, like that.
So you know that faith will help you reach the goal of ruchi, and after that loba will work, right?
Sure.
So once the ruchi stage is reached, the faith becomes stagnant?
No, it's a powerful form of faith. Like the faith that we have in the beginning of Krishna consciousness has to be evolved. As Krishna also uses that name, sattva anurupa, sarvasya shraddha bhavati bharata. He says that according to the quality of your existence, sattva, sat means existent, tva means the quality of. So according to the quality of your existence, then you will evolve your faith. Of course, Krishna has mentioned that in terms of the modes of nature and context. But then when there's an investment of transcendental shraddha, by contacting a devotee, he makes an investment in our heart, called as the bhakti lata bija, the nirguna shraddha. That bhakti lata bija is their nirguna shraddha, transcendental faith. So that's the initial investment that we gain from the fortunate opportunity to associate with pure devotees. And then from there you have to expand the capital through the process of sadhana. Just like someone may make an initial investment, then you have to expand the capital if you want the business to grow. So similarly, the association of pure devotees gives the initial investment, and then we have to expand the capital in the form of sadhana bhakti, headed by shravanam and kirtanam. And then when the capital becomes healthy, like you have a healthy amount, then that's called ruchi. And what shraddha is now acting in a more powerful way. One, in the beginning, buddhi yoga, like, as I mentioned, the intellect is very much required. And then when there's ruchi, then that ruchi takes over from there. Sound like intelligence is out or something.
So it's called a condensed faith.
Yeah, it's more condensed. Anything else? Yeah.
Yeah, just continuing on Imanshu's point, before he asked the question, I was wondering if we could explore the topic of how you become your faith in our lives as devotees, aspiring devotees, how that principle, I don't have a specific question, but it's just this really nice point to meditate on, how whatever faith, you know, and the faith we have seems to be based on what we hear, what we have access to. So how is it that we can remain, or we can achieve access to that which we need to hear to guide us to achieve the type of faith that's required to achieve the ultimate goal? Or maybe you can just expand on, as devotees, how this faith will...
Yeah, I think I explained it already by saying, by the fortunate association of Vaishnava, Brahmanda Brahmite Konna Bhagyavan Jiva. So the Bhagyavan Jiva is one who gets a chance to associate with a pure devotee, and the initial investment is transcendental faith. Faith in the spiritual world, faith in Krishna, faith in the process, etc. This is all within the realm of transcendental faith. And then you have to expand that capital by the process of hearing and chanting from the pure devotees, from studying the shastras, etc. So like that. Then as we're expanding the capital, our faith is becoming more condensed in the language of Parama Karuna. And as it becomes more condensed, you're embodying that which you've had faith in more and more and more. Just like this analogy is given in a different way in the commentaries of the Charas of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14:27. When Krishna says Brahmano hi pratishtaham, that he is the basis of Brahman. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a nice visual that the sun globe, I don't know, the sun globe, sun planet, whatever, is just condensed light. So when light is more, how you say, spread out, dispersed. When light is more dispersed, it is less strong. And then when it becomes more condensed, you have a sun planet. So he says, Krishna is condensed Brahman. Is condensed Brahman. So he's also light as well as he's the source of light, but he's condensed light or condensed Brahman. So I, using that kind of image, our Shraddha is more dispersed in the beginning because we're just coming in contact with the process with devotees. We're not edified in the Siddhanta and all that. And then as we hear more and more and more, that Shraddha is becoming more and more condensed until you actually embody it fully. Like that. So that's a good image, I think, of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives us, and that's kind of like the idea.
That faith that simply by engaging devotional service one can achieve.
Yes, so we understand Shraddha to be, you know, transcendental faith. That's what it's called, is Nirguna Shraddha. It means faith in Krishna. Faith that just by serving Krishna, everything will be accomplished. Which is, you know, the full trust. What is, how is it called? Shraddha Shabde Vishwasa. Vishwasa means full trust. You know, just like in drama class. I don't know if any of you ever had to do this in drama class, but you had to do this exercise of falling back and the partner's supposed to catch you. And if you ever remember doing that in like elementary school? And how many of you could do it? I never could do it because I'm like, this shorty is so weak. He's gonna drop me, you know. You were kind of like going like, oh no, I'm not doing that. You know, you could never trust a person because he was as big as you. You know, he's gonna drop me, obviously. But if you had like your strong father or something, you fall back, you know, he's gonna catch you. So Vishrasha means his full. I just like that image as an image for trust, the full trust that Krishna will take care of me, Shraddha. So the devotee doesn't find a necessity to meditate on his maintenance so much and all of that, because he has full faith Krishna will take care. Just like this past time in Gaur Lila, I've mentioned it many times, with when Lord Chaitanya inquired from Srivas, why is it that you have big house, big family, but you're not looking at any anxiety about maintenance or anything, nor do I see you working or anything. And he just claps his hand three times. And Lord Chaitanya asked, well, what's the meaning of that? And he says, if one day the Lord does not provide for me, then that day we will fast. Me and my whole family will fast. Second day the Lord does not provide for me, that day also we will fast and do tapasya. Third day the Lord does not provide for me, that day also we will fast. On the fourth day, if nothing comes, I'll drown myself in the Ganga. And Lord Chaitanya glorified him for his faith. Now we should not imitate that because our faith is dispersed right now. First day, second day, third day we'll fast, fourth day we'll leave the movement. So we shouldn't imitate. Anyway, you can't imitate. That's the amazing thing about Krishna consciousness, is that you can't imitate. Prabhupada says those who follow the Vedas and those who don't, both of them prove the Vedas true. Which is I always found that to be a very extraordinary point. Because you can see if persons really don't have faith, as I mentioned, faith governs movement. So if you don't have that faith, you can't even imitate even if you try. Where there is suspicion, there is suspension. Srila Sridhar Maharaj statement, which I always appreciate. So you can't imitate these things. It's completely impossible. So when we have real shared knowledge, it will behoove all beginning sadhakas who depend more on their intelligence than their ruchi, because our ruchi is undeveloped, to study Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's shared nagati songs to see what it really means to be a surrendered soul. Because in the first half of our cultivation, it's really about progressing our faith, maturing our faith, which will externally manifest as Sharanagati. So Sharanagati, we know, well, Sharanagati is accepting that which is favorable, rejecting that which is unfavorable. But the Vinod Thakur wrote songs in order to detail what that means. Otherwise, it remains a fuzzy mental concoction in the mind. So it behooves all of us to really understand what is Sharanagati. Because that's the doorway into entering into the real realm of bhakti proper, as opposed to bhakti abhas, which we, in the beginning stages, practice as such. So I think that the imagery is very nice, it's very clear. Like that. Okay.
was studying Bhagavad Gita this morning, and I noticed how both chapter 3 and chapter 5 open with like a similar question from Arjuna. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about where his faith is at in those two chapters.
Well, it's in the beginning stages for the play.
There's some distinction, though, because it seems like in chapter 5, he's getting a slightly different response versus chapter 3.
No, actually, Krishna is just expanding the same point throughout the entirety of the Bhagavad Gita. That's what makes the Bhagavad Gita interesting, is that Krishna gives a seed understanding in chapter 2. Basically, in verses 11 through 15, that's basically the seed. Everything is practically there in those few verses. Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana, everything is there. But it's there in the seed form, so then Krishna has to expand that. So to clarify everything, to clarify the Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana, he expands it. That becomes the Bhagavad Gita. So he's always talking about basically one topic. In short, consciousness is attached to matter. That's the source of our problem. The way to get consciousness to be detached from matter is the process of yoga. On the transcendental stage, these are what goes on. Those are the basic elements of the Bhagavad Gita. And so in chapter 3 and 5, he gives the same point. Krishna in chapter 3 talks about karma and gyan being two aspects of one process. Chapter 5, he says the same thing. Arjuna is confused because in chapter 3, he understands karma yoga leads to the development of gyan, and the gyani has an adhikar for being renounced. So then, after Krishna speaks about that in chapter 4, at the very last verse, he says, so you should, armed with yoga, you should fight. So then Arjuna gets confused. Wait, I thought the gyani has adhikar for renunciation, now why do I have to fight? So then Krishna clarifies that he's actually speaking about a blend of the two. He's not really saying that they're distinct processes, that you should do karma infused with proper knowledge. In other words, Krishna's gradually bringing us closer to the idea of bhakti, which is activity with a proper conceptual orientation in relationship to Krishna. But he doesn't just bust out and say that because we're all envious. So he gradually brings us through six chapters of self-realization, which we can appreciate because it has nothing to do with him. In a very direct sort of way. He doesn't speak about himself in great detail as he does in chapters 7 through 12, especially in chapter 9. So he's bringing us to this idea of doing activity, which is bhakti, cheshtarupa. There's activity involved with a proper conceptual orientation in relationship to Krishna. In the stage of sadhana, we conceive of it in a mature way, how we are servants of Krishna. And when that sambandhagan becomes mature, it's called Swarup Siddhi, and you have a realized conceptual orientation in relationship to Krishna, and you do activity, which is what Krishna's kind of bringing us to, action for him, in short. So he's always speaking about the same thing, but he's just developing it in a systematic way, helping averse jivas gradually get on board. Okay, any other points? No? Okay, I'll do a few more verses then. I didn't expect so many questions. I finished at 8:40. I'll do a few more hell verses. I was hoping that we could get a little further. To be honest with you, we could just read through the chapter because knowing the details of material existence is not really that important, because Krishna says in the Gita, Abrahma bhuvana loka punara varchuna arjuna mamupete tukonte apunar janmana vidite, that from the topmost planet down to the bottommost, all are places of misery. So what's the point in knowing details about that? Well, this is miserable in this way, this is miserable in that way. Oh, very interesting, very interesting. It's like wanting to know what's the difference between wet stool and dry stool. Well, what's the difference between wet stool and dry stool? Now, if you ask any human being that, they're going to look at you like you're insane, especially if you look really inquisitive about it. So also knowing the details of how the material existence is a house of misery is not as important as understanding the underlying principle by which one gets these variety of experiences. The underlying principle is that we're under the modes of nature. We're hearing about hell because hell means that there's an increase of the tamagun. So then these are the type of experiences that one gains when there's an increase in the tamagun. So then the simple message would be, get out of the tamagun, cultivate bhakti for us at least, and transcend the material nature. Later on, we'll hear in the sixth canto, first chapter, the Yamadutas speaking very nicely. Even they're very intelligent. They speak very nicely, saying how the Vishnu Dutas ask them, who is punishable in the material nature? To which, when the Yamadutas respond, they say, actually, everyone is punishable because everyone is controlled by the modes of nature. So sometimes, although they're in goodness, sometimes they're in the mode of passion and ignorance and they're doing improper things, and so they're viable for punishment. So anyone who's under the modes is viable to be punished. The Yamadutas give an explanation like this, which is very nice. So then the message is get out of the influence of the modes of nature. And how does one do that? Yes.
Bhakti.
How does one do that? Get out of the modes of nature. Yes, surrender to Krishna. Daivyesha guru mayi, mama maya dharatya, mama evaye papadhyante. By surrender to Krishna, then you can get out of the influence. So then this is the basic thing. So going into great discussion about this hell, that hell, that is not as important as the information that will help us cultivate bhava for Krishna. So this is just to give us a little idea that material existence sucks. For those of you who want to stay in it by not serving the Krishna, here's some of the variety that you'll experience in the material nature. So we'll read some more hell-raising verses here. Text number 16. In his next life, a sinful king or governmental representative who punishes an innocent person or who inflicts corporal punishment upon a brahmana is taken by the Yamadutas to the hell named Sukaramukha, where the most powerful assistants of Yamaraj crush him exactly as one crushes sugarcane to squeeze out the juice. That sounds painful. The sinful entity cries very pitiably and faints, as I can imagine, just like an innocent man undergoing punishments. This is the result of punishing a faultless person. Next verse. By the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, low-grade living beings like bugs and mosquitoes suck the blood of human beings and other animals. Such insignificant creatures are unaware that their bites are painful to the human being. However, first-class human beings, brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas, are developed in consciousness, and therefore they know how painful it is to be killed. A human being endowed with knowledge certainly commits sin if he kills or torments insignificant creatures who have no discrimination. The Supreme Lord punishes such a man by putting him into the hell known as Andakupa, where he is attacked by all the birds and beasts, reptiles, mosquitoes, lice, worms, flies, and any other creatures he tormented during his life. They attack him from all sides, robbing him of the pleasure of sleep. Unable to rest, he constantly wanders about in the darkness. Thus, in Andakupa, his suffering is just like a creature in the lower species. So that sucks. I was somehow the Mayapur was coming to mind as I was reading this because the mosquitoes there are very intense, and if you don't have proper mosquito net, then they also rob you of sleep. So we get a slight experience of hellish experiences. Of course, we may say those mosquitoes are transcendental because they're Dhamvasis, and that might make us feel better about it, of course, but that doesn't help you to sleep. There's a purport to this verse. From this very instructive verse, we learn that lower animals created by the laws of nature to disturb the human being are not subjected to punishment. Because the human being has developed consciousness, however, he cannot do anything against the principles of Varnashram Dharma without being condemned. Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita, Chatur Varanyam Mayashrishtam Guna Karma Vipagashaha. According to the three modes of material nature and the work ascribed to them, the four divisions of human society were created by me. Thus, all men should be divided into four classes, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, and they should not act according to their ordained regulations. They should act according to their ordained regulations. They cannot deviate from their prescribed rules and regulations. One of these states that they should never trouble any animal, even those that disturb human beings. Although a tiger is not sinful if he attacks another animal and eats its flesh, if a man with developed consciousness does so, he must be punished. In other words, a human being who does not use his developed consciousness but instead acts like an animal surely undergoes punishment in many different hells. I mean, this chapter basically just says that everyone's going to hell. I guess the Christians had it right on one thing. Y'all find that amusing? The Christians are always saying everyone's going to hell, and it looks like they're right. Not because of not accepting Jesus, but because there is no Varnashram context for which people can cultivate proper understanding of existence and so on. And so naturally, being without such knowledge and subsequently without such consciousness, they inherently are doing activities which will send them to hell. So then the only hope for anyone in this age of Kali is the Sankirtan Yajna, Kalera Dosha Nide Raja. Asti Eko Mahaguna Kirtana Neva Krishnasha Mukta Sangha. If you want freedom from this bad Sangha of material existence, then one should take shelter of the holy name of Krishna. So are there any other questions? Any final points? I'm going to end there because I think it's a good spot to stop. There's 40 verses, so I'll not be able to finish it like I had hoped I could do. Is there anything else anyone would like to say? No? Okay then. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.